بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. إن الحمد لله والصلاة والسلام على رسول الله ما بعد. Brothers and sisters, I greet you with the warmest Islamic greetings of peace. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. For those who don't know any Arabic, that basically means may the peace and blessings of God be upon every single one of you. Even if you don't believe God exists, even if you don't believe Allah exists, and there are people in this room who don't care, who have suspended those questions, or don't even believe in the deity or the divine. They don't believe, full stop, period. I don't want to know. But even if you don't believe, you must all thank Allah. Why am I saying this? Hamza Dud, this is crazy. That's true, but that's a different topic. Why is Hamza Dud saying, even if you don't believe in the divine, you must thank the divine? Even if you don't believe in Allah, you must thank Allah. Why am I saying this? Well, the reason I'm saying this is because Allah, as a result of Islam, gave us three important pillars of Western civilization. And without them, we wouldn't be a civilization. Number one, the presumption of innocence. Number two, tolerance. Number three, scientific progress, the scientific revolution in the 15th and 16th century. You don't believe me, do you? Well, let me tell you why. Islam is not just a religion, it's what we call a deen in Arabic, which means a way of life. It's a comprehensive idea, concept, and from it emanates various concepts and values to live our life and to form a unique, successful civilization. This is why Adam Smith, who is that very funny looking guy at the back of your £20 note, who is the 18th century founder of modern economics, he said that if it wasn't for the tranquility of the caliphate, the Islamic governance, the principles of Islam with regards to social political context, if it wasn't for those things, we would never have people within that society to look into the interconnecting principles of nature and develop and facilitate the Renaissance. Adam Smith. Even Thomas Arnold, a famous historian, he writes, it was Islamic Spain that was the key milestone for the facilitation of the Renaissance, the facilitation for the scientific revolution. So your iPad, your iPhone, what a stupid thing, the iPad. It's in between an iPhone and a laptop. We never really needed it, but they gave it to us, right? Consumerism. That's what consumerism is. It says you have too many needs, and we know which needs they are. And by the way, we have a product for you. That's consumerism. Anyway, different topic. But the point is, brothers, sisters, and friends, Islam facilitated the Renaissance because of Islamic Spain, as per the words of Professor Thomas Arnold. Islamic Spain, when it was taken over after by the Christians, particularly Toledo, many of the Western scholars, they traveled to Islamic Spain, or what was Islamic Spain, and what did they find? They found libraries, they found literature, they found analytic material, they found scholarship, which resulted from the social, political principles that Islam taught its rulers, so they can apply within that environment, so they could produce these works. And we have, for instance, Adelard of Bath and Daniel of Morley, two amazing English scholars, of which traveled to Toledo, took the Arabic manuscripts that came as a result of the Islamic principles to develop that amazing environment for the cultivation of the sciences, and they took it back to England. And what did they form, people? Oxford University. Your first choice, by the way. And many of Western scholars, they traveled to Islamic Spain to translate these works, and hence it formed the basis for chemistry, for astronomy, for geology, and all these different sciences. So the Renaissance was as a result of Islam, which is as a result of Allah. So thank Allah, even if you don't believe in Him. The second point that I like to mention is the presumption of innocence. Every single one of you could walk into a court and say, I am not guilty. You have to prove me wrong. I didn't take that spliff. Isn't that right, bro? It wasn't me. It wasn't me. I thought it was herbal medicine. Yeah? The student outcry. You could walk into any court and assume innocence before you're proven guilty. And this was a direct inference from the Islamic tradition. King Louis IX, he is well known to have established the principle of the presumption of innocence. You're innocent before you're proven guilty. But before King Louis IX, when he took it from the Muslims, and I'm going to explain how, before he did that, to prove your innocence, you had to fight in a duel, or you'd be burnt alive, and if you survived, you're pronounced non-guilty, not guilty. King Louis IX met a monk, and this monk read the Quran, which is the book of the Muslims, and also read the prophetic traditions attributed to the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, upon whom be peace. And he directly quotes a prophetic tradition with regards to justice. And we know from a justice perspective, Islam was the first civilization that actually had a very strong element of justice and the presumption of innocence. It's in our tradition. This is why Richard W. Bullier, a historian, in his publication, The Case for the Islamo-Christian Civilization, says that justice was meted out impartially, irrespective of religious and status. This is where we have the likes of Jewish historians like Amnon Cohen in his book, A World Within. He says that although the Jews had the choice to go to the rabbinical courts, they didn't want to go. They went to the Qadi, which means the Islamic judge. To the point, if you read some of these records, women would go to the Islamic judge and complain they're not getting enough money. We want more nafaqah. Nafaqah is an Islamic concept of maintenance for the woman. For her clothes, for her makeup. Because she doesn't have to pay for that, by the way. It's economic liberty for you. Her education, her house. And if the man can't afford it, the government does. Say that to David Cameron with the 90,000 almost homeless in Britain. So if you read the works of the academic Marcel Boissard in his article, essay, called The Probable Influence of Islam on the Presumption of Innocence, you see in detail how Islam facilitated the most important maxim in Western legal theory, which is you must be innocent before you're proven guilty. The next point is tolerance. We live in a secular society that preaches tolerance. It says you must tolerate the minority, you must tolerate each other, which is good, which is excellent. But the historians say, like Christopher Walker in his book, Islam in the West, this is a direct result of the Islamic tradition, because if you look into European history, what happened, people? You had religion saying to people, no, you can't say that, or you get a slap. It was a huge slap because they had the 80-year wars, the 30-year wars, the massacre on St. Bartholomew's Day. Europe had an issue with religion, particularly an interpretation of the Catholic tradition. Now, we're not saying it's their fault, the Catholics' fault, no. But there was a reality between religion and the thinkers and the masses and people who wanted to break away from this. And as a result of this environment, you had the likes of Locke, Hume, Hobbes, Hugo Grotius, Samuel Pufendorf, and many others, who basically wanted to look into natural law in an individualistic sense, which basically means to divorce it away from God's perceived will for society. Because they said, religion's not working, God's not working. Let's look at natural law and human rights and what is the self in an individualized sense, an atomized sense. Because therefore you won't need religion anymore. Because there's something inherent in an individual that transcends religious doctrine. Which was fair enough from that perspective. And Locke, who was attributed to write treatises on tolerance and his book on civil governance, he was directly influenced by Islamic philosophy and thinking. His main teacher, who he writes about this teacher that he loved to sit in his lectures, was who? Edward Pocock. Edward Pocock was the 17th century Orientalist. He was called the Orientalist, the first Orientalist. And he traveled to places like the East and took the Islamic manuscripts, and he was the lecturer of Islamic studies at Oxford University. And John Locke would sit at his lectures and learn and acquire knowledge, especially on concepts of tolerance. And that's amazing. Now, if you read John Locke's work on civil governance, he mentions that leadership is a divine trust, a vicegerency. What does that mean in the Islamic tradition? The khilafah. The sultanate, directly almost taken from Islamic theology. So, I like to mention this because it breaks the ice, has nothing to do with the topic, of course. But the reason I like mentioning this is because everyone's shocked. Islam gave us these things? So Islam is not an enemy anymore. It's not a foe, it's a friend. The Islamic tradition is a friend, not a foe, because it gave us the presumption of innocence. Thank Allah. It gave us tolerance, thank Allah. It gave us the scientific revolution in the 15th and 16th century, the Renaissance. Thank Allah. So even if you don't believe in Allah, you must thank Him. Right? Because we got all these nice things from this imaginary deity. So let's go to the topic. I just came back from an amazing trip, came back from an amazing trip in Pakistan. Or as my son says, Pasikan. Papa, you were Pasikan, you're Pasikan. So yes, I went to Pasikan. So in my trip in Pasikan, I had an amazing journey, 2 weeks of, I can't describe, it was very spiritual, it was amazing. I connected with human beings in a way that I've never connected before. And I connected with my own stomach in ways I never connected before. I had a chapli kebab. Do you know what chapli kebab is? Yeah. It basically means a slipper kebab. And it was made of slippers, people. Because my stomach. I had some... don't want to get into the detail. So, the main point I'm trying to say is that as a result, I learned about Pakistani culture, from a philosophical perspective. And they have an amazing man in their history called Dr. Muhammad Iqbal, also known as the Poet of the East, Allama Iqbal. Who's heard of him? You probably learn his poems when you're children. He's an amazing character, and I've just read recently one of his amazing gems that made me speechless. And he said, and I'm paraphrasing, that in the East, our philosophy and thinking has been consumed. Has been consumed by the question, does God exist? But then he says and asserts, I want to give everybody a new question, one that's relatively new, especially for the East. And that question is, does man exist? It's saying in my hairs are on end. Now the shallow amongst us will say, obviously we exist. Duh. Okay, let me just really get that internal thinking out of your mind at the moment. Let me just wash it away for a bit, yeah? But what is Muhammad Iqbal trying to say? Forget the question, does God exist? I have a new question for you. Do you exist? Does man exist? The most profound question we don't even ask ourselves. We're always externally looking all the time. But what does the Quranic discourse say? وَفِي أَنفُسِكُمْ أَفَلَا تُبْصِرُونَ. And in themselves, do they not see? أَوَلَمْ يَتَفَكَّرُوا فِي أَنفُسِهِمْ. Do they not reflect within themselves the inner physiological and psychological and spiritual dimensions of man? But it's even further. And there is an even further question here, which relates to the question, who are you? Do you really exist, the sense of self, you? Are you you? Who are you? But these are profound questions. If I ask anyone in this room who you are, how are you going to answer that question? You're going to say, oh, I'm Pakistani or Pasikani. I'm Pakistani. I'm Indian. I'm Greek. That looks Pakistani. I'm a student. I'm a Muslim. I'm a Christian. I'm a human. All these abstract terms that we don't really internalize and we don't know what's going on. Because in reality, our sense of self is just a reaction. Because we're just a reaction to our upbringing. I'm my parents. I'm my DNA. I'm my biology. I'm my social, political circumstance. I'm from the West. I'm a Westerner. I'm from the East. I came to the West. So I'm a Westerner. God knows what I am. Identity crisis. Confusion. So who are you? But these are profound questions, people. Who are you? And it reminds me of a famous American writer that once wrote, being born is like being kidnapped and sold into slavery. Because we're all slaves to these things, people. And you think you're special? You think you're unique? With the quiff on the left? Come on, man. Are we unique? Surely some people say we're just matter, right? And if we're just matter, then it doesn't really matter. Does it matter the universe existed? Does it really matter if it didn't exist or it exists? We're going to become worm buffet anyway one day, right? Who cares? Does it make any difference? What is this sentimentalism going on here? Why are you being so sentimental for? You're just a rearrangement of molecules. That's it. Who cares? Why attribute anything profound to yourself like morality or good and bad? It makes no difference. When there's a killing in Iraq, it's not an innocent person dying. It's just a rearrangement of molecules. So we're just a slave to these things, aren't we, people? We're just a slave, aren't we? But you don't like to think like that, do you? You're going to be a slave to these material, blind, deterministic processes? That I'm just a reaction to my society? To my upbringing? To my DNA? To social, biological context? This guy is going to lead England one day. Because he must have such bravery to walk past me like that in the middle of my lecture. With his hood on. So, are we just a reaction to these things, people? But I know you don't want to think like that, and I believe you. Because I don't believe I'm a reaction to these things. But how are we going to free ourselves from these things, people? How do we free ourselves from these things? Because we're always slaves. Your whole concept of freedom, there's probably a secular society in this campus, or a liberal society, well, God knows what. And freedom is such a divine thing for them. It's like gospel truth. You must be free. Liberty. Freedom of speech. I'm free to do what I want, as long as it doesn't harm anyone. These concepts are very religious these days. But they're just bakwas. From the Pakistani perspective. Bak means like chit-chatter, right? But it's true. It's just philosophically they have no basis. Don't get me wrong. I like these principles, the Islamic principles, especially freedom of speech, which I'm so often misquoted about. That freedom of speech or liberty to express yourself actually came from the 9th century in the Islamic tradition. Many people attribute liberty to express yourself from the Islamic tradition, so it's part of our heritage. But philosophically, from an absolutist perspective, we're all slaves. And there's three types of slavery in the Islamic tradition. Slave to the lower self, to your desires, to the nafs, to the ego. Slave to social processes, as the Quran says. Are you going to follow your forefathers, even if they were based on falsehood? Very existential question. You're just going to react to them? Who are you? Or you're a slave to God. A And by being a true servant to the divine, you free yourself from these things. So in our pursuit of happiness and our pursuit for freedom, the light at the end of the tunnel is the divine from this perspective. And I challenge anybody from an existential point of view, what it means to exist, if they could challenge this process. You're either slave to yourself, to others, or to the divine. So I think Muhammad Iqbal had a very good point. But let's get straight to the topic. Does God exist? I think it's good to speak about these things in the beginning, because it just breaks the ice. It shows that religion or Islam or Allah is not a concept that has not benefited mankind. And also, it makes us think within ourselves, so we know that this topic is not just an abstract philosophical discussion, because I'm not into intellectual gymnastics, okay? Or any other type of gymnastics, obviously, yeah? 110 kilos, we're a bit hard doing all those rope things, yeah? Whatever they do, yeah? So, does God exist? This is the perennial question. It's a very important question. Fundamentally, you don't really have to prove it. Why do you? Why do you have to prove that God exists? Why? From the Islamic tradition, there's an argument that we believe this is innate, which means fitrah. The fitrah is a concept from our tradition, from the Quran and the prophetic tradition, that gives us this axiom. It's a universal premise that we take, that we build our whole worldview. God exists, there is no argument. And this is what you call in philosophy as a properly basic belief. A belief that is required to shape all other beliefs. Just like in scientism, which asserts that everything must be verified or proven scientifically to be true. And the basis for that is based on faith. But you didn't know that. Does the real world exist? Does it exist? Does it exist?
Of course.
Prove it. Because you're a clever guy. You know you can't prove the real world exists. How can you? Because then I could claim, well, maybe your brain is on Mars and there's two probes in there and that alien is making you think the way you think. The Matrix. I know Kung Fu. That's when you need the weed, bro, at that time. What a crazy film. Not that I advocate using weed, of course. So the point is, from this basic perspective, it's a properly basic belief. I don't need to prove it. You can't prove the basis of your knowledge. Why should I prove the basis of mine? But I'm going to show you some evidence anyway. But I like to start this way because it creates an interesting paradigm. Because people always think that the religious people have to be on the back foot. We have all the proving to do. Well, you prove your basis of your perspective. Everything needs an axiom. Everything requires a universal principle that you can't prove, but you require to build the rest of your worldview. That's philosophy for you. But Richard Dawkins doesn't want you to think philosophically. I was in Ireland a few months ago, well, actually last year, and I attended the World Atheist Convention. And someone asked him a question, Richard Dawkins, and said, "Professor, shall I study the philosophy of science?" And he said, "No, just do the science." Then I asked him a question, I interviewed him, I said, "Richard Dawkins, thank you very much for your presentation. I would like to ask you a question. Why did you tell people not to study the philosophy of science?" He didn't really reply. And I think I know why, because as a result of reading something small about the philosophy of science, you see that it's not the gospel truth anymore. Because Richard Dawkins advocates a particular view on science, his epistemological thesis, which basically means his view on how we can attain knowledge is the following. You must prove everything scientifically. Everything that you must believe in must be proven scientifically. Well, let's analyze that. The statement itself is self-annihilating, self-defeating. Because the statement, everything that you need to believe in must be proven scientifically, can't be proven scientifically. So it kills itself from the onset. It shoots itself in the foot. Bang! Also, scientism requires logically necessary truths like mathematics. 1 + 1 = 2. These are logically necessary that don't require affirmation in the empirical world. And scientism requires mathematics and logically necessary truths before you can even have science in the first place. To argue the other way around is like shooting yourself in the foot, or rather, a dog trying to catch his tail. So scientism has a limited scope, people. It's not the only way to knowledge. Don't let people, the white coats, the new religion, I call them, the white coats. And they're not all like that, only the very extreme. But don't let the new white coats blind your mind and stop your conceptual thinking, this is the only way to truth. Because it's not true even philosophically. Also, scientism can't prove morality. Although there has been an attempt by one of the four horsemen, the atheist, Sam Harris, in his book, The Moral Landscape. And he said, science can prove morality. And we call it well-being. And he calls it the peaks and the troughs of well-being. And on the peaks, you have people who have well-being. And on the troughs, you have people who don't have any well-being. And there you go, science can prove morality. Well, he's done a big mistake, which he mentions as well at the end of his book, that he's conflating well-being with morality. Because someone who has well-being can also be immoral, like a thief or a pedophile. So his philosophy breaks down. Also, on a more humorous level, it doesn't work practically. Imagine going to your wife. Imagine she's Pakistani, you've learned some Urdu. And you say to her, Meri Jaan, my life, Sonu, my darling, yeah? I love you. And she gives you a slap. Wake up, beta. It's only chemicals in your brain, y'all. Yeah? Imagine that. Imagine we reduce everything and we're trying to verify it from a scientism perspective. It doesn't make sense. It's a sentimentalism. Why add these things? You're just being sentimental. Grow up. You're just A plus B, therefore C. Get lost. That's why Nietzsche, he was, for me, a very true atheist. I take my hat off him for him. I do. I honor him from that perspective because he was honest. Because he knew the logical consequence of not having the divine. Read his works. They're fascinating. So, scientism. We've discussed that. Now let's go to the argument for the existence of God. One of the biggest questions in Western Eastern philosophy is, does God exist? For example, a question referring to this from the British philosopher Derek Parfit. He said, we should ask the question, why does something exist rather than nothing? Also, you had the German polymath Leibniz. He said, the first question that must be asked and answered is, why does something exist rather than nothing? Why are we here? What is the structure of the universe? How did it become to be? Why? And these are profound questions. Typically, in response to this, atheists have asserted, especially Bertrand Russell in a radio program in the 1960s, he's almost like the godfather of modern atheism, from a philosophical perspective. He said, the universe is a brute fact. It's just there. It's just there, people. It's a brute fact. Didn't begin, won't end. It's just this, in your face. So don't even think about it. He even added, to think about it will get you depressed. Just live your life in this self-delusional way. Now, if we reflect upon this conclusion, I would argue that it is irrational. Why? Because if the universe never had a beginning and never had an end, it implies that the past is infinite. Think about it. If there is no beginning, no end, it implies the past is infinite. That the universe has an infinite history of past events. Think about this carefully. The universe has an infinite history of past events. But I want to ask you a question. Can the infinite exist in the real world? Can it exist? Well, it exists in mathematics, based on axioms and conventions. It may exist because we think the divine is an infinite, but that type of infinite is the qualitative infinite, not the infinite of discrete parts. So can the infinite with discrete parts and segments actually exist in the real world? No. This is what the philosophers say. There is no ontological export. There's no export of the concept into the real world. Let me give you an example. Say we had an infinite number of bottles in this room. If I take 5 bottles away, how many bottles do I have left? Infinity. Infinity minus 5. I don't know what the hell is going on. Yeah? Exactly. It leads to paradoxes and confusion. Let me give you another example. Say we had 100 bottles in this room, and at every possible moment, I add another bottle. Bottle 101, bottle 102, bottle 103, bottle 1,000,001. Very complex nursery rhyme. Who said the nursery rhyme? 5 green bottles. Yeah? You don't have any nieces or nephews? Come on. You were a kid once as well, you know. So, would I ever reach a number of bottles I could describe as infinite? No, because what about n plus 1? I could add another one all the time. So the potential from this perspective, rather the infinite from this perspective, is potential, is never actualized. That's why Aristotle said that the infinite is just potential. It's never actualized. So if we apply this to the history of the universe must have a beginning because the history of the universe is real. They are real things, past events. So therefore, the universe must have a beginning. So all I'm saying is that the universe must have a beginning. Even from a scientific perspective, and this is just a supporting argument, it's not gospel truth, because science changes and evolves. But our current understanding of cosmology indicates there is a spatial-temporal boundary, which means that the universe is almost like a finite object. It began to exist. T is equal to zero. Time is equal to zero. And we've heard of things like the Big Bang. Who's heard of the Big Bang? Good. And it's not that thing that happens after too many curries, okay? or in Schottingham. Yeah, in Nottingham, it's got a reputation for being Schottingham, isn't it? Yeah, Big Bangs. Yeah. Are you innocent folk, man? I'm from Hackney in London, very dangerous place, okay? Who's heard of Hackney before? Good. What have you heard about it?
It's the worst place in London.
It's the worst place in London. Good. Just meet me outside after, yeah? So, the Big Bang Theory, or its various interpretations such as the oscillating model, the quantum fluctuation model, and others. I don't want to baffle you with technicalities here. But these models all necessitate beginning in time due to concepts like the second law of thermodynamics, for instance, acausal fine-tuning, metastability, and all these other things that we could discuss in the Q&A. But the point is, from an astrophysical perspective, there's a beginning in time. This is why one of the leading theoretical cosmologists, Alexander Vilenkin, in 2006, he said we can't run away from the beginning of the universe now. So all we're saying here is that the universe began to exist. It came into being. The universe came into being. So from this perspective, there are only some possible explanations. There are only some possible explanations. These explanations are 3. If you could find any other explanation, please let me know. But the logical possible explanations are, the universe came from nothing, the universe created itself, or the universe was created. And interestingly, these are the principles that the Quran, the book of the Muslims, tell us about the creation of the human being. And from an exegetical perspective, understanding the Quran, these principles can be applied to everything that begins to exist, everything that comes into creation. So the universe began to exist, which we've shown philosophically and scientifically. It began to exist. But how? Did it come from nothing? Did it create itself? Or was it created? These are the logical possibilities. And let's work together. Let's discuss the first point. Can the universe come from nothing? No, it can't. How can the universe come from nothing? Because out of nothing, what comes, people? Nothing. Kuch nahi. As you Pakistanis say. There's actually a famous saying in Pakistan, it's called Muchne de Kuchne. If you don't have a moustache, you have nothing. There's another saying I learned about Lahore. It's a big city in Pakistan, and they say, if you've never been to Lahore, you've never been born. But why did I go there and I feel like dying? crazy place. There is no sense of traffic in that country. Every car looks like it's been hammered by a big guy with a sledgehammer. Because you hear, we had about 4 accidents. Some guy's knee nearly went left field. Yeah, honestly, it was crazy on a motorbike. Anyway, this is my experiences of my Pakistan trip. Out of nothing, nothing comes. This is why P.J. Swart, in his publication About Time, said, if there is anything that we can find inconceivable, people, is that something could arise from nothing. And that's so true. But there is a contention to this. Some physicists say, no, you can have things coming out of nothing. And they talk about the quantum vacuum. They say particles emerge from the quantum vacuum out of nothing. But there's a problem with language here. We're saying the universe began to exist. So matter, the sum of matter, all mass, came into being. From where? There was no mass preceding it. So it's absolutely nothing. But the quantum physicists are saying the quantum field, which is not nothing, it's something. Because the quantum field has a rich structure, it's a sea of fluctuating energy, and it obeys the laws of the universe. This is why the Christian philosopher of science, John Polkinghorne, he says the universe is not nothing, it's actually something. It has this rich structure. So that contention is not a valid contention. So the next point, since we know out of nothing, nothing comes. For instance, if I had a box with nothing in it, then all of a sudden I gave you a teddy bear, you'd be like, that's impossible. You did a trick. This is why when we watch magic tricks, and we see things coming, another brave man in the audience, yeah? We see things coming from a hat, like a rabbit, or a bunch of flowers, we know it's just a trick. So something cannot come from nothing. The second option, can it create itself? Can the universe create itself? Can it create itself, brother? Why? Q. Why, brother? You no idea. Who knows? Yes?
Because to create itself, it already has to exist.
To create itself, it would already have to exist. A logician in the room. Stand up, young man. Sit down, young man. Obedience. You see that? He doesn't even know me from Adam. And even if your dad said that, you probably wouldn't stand up, yeah? Money kidding. Thanks. It's very good. Because it implies that something exists and doesn't exist at the same time. That doesn't make any sense. Let me make it very easy for you. Can your mother give birth to herself? It'll be very messy, right? Don't even imagine it. Yeah? However, there is another contention. Here comes Stephen Hawking from left field. He writes in his new book, The Grand Design, which, funny enough, in his introduction, he says philosophy is dead. And when you read the book, it's full of philosophy. Interestingly, it's full of his philosophical interpretations of physics. The irony. Anyway, he says that because of the concept of gravity, the universe can self-create. This may be coherent mathematically, but the mathematics in physics has various interpretations in the real world. So the issue is he right? Well, philosophically, I think he's damn wrong. Not from an arrogant perspective, but what is the law of gravity? It's the force of attraction between two masses. So you need mass before you have mass. That's what he's saying. In a way, he's saying you have the universe before you have the universe. Now, frankly, all he's really saying is the quantum field with gravity, then the universe emerged. But all he's doing is just expanding the scope of the universe because the quantum field is part of the universe. So that's not a very healthy contention. So we've dealt with the universe can come at nothing. We've dealt with the universe cannot self-create. So what's the last possible explanation? That the universe was created. Or in a philosophical terms, whatever begins to exist has a cause. Whatever begins to exist has a cause. Small bang, because of my hand. Big bang, because of the divine hand. That's, you know. Do you see the point? Not to anthropomorphize the situation, yeah? So this is why whatever begins to exist has a cause. Now there is a contention here. And the reason I like mentioning contentions, because I want to move away from outdated atheist cliches and have a dialogue and have a discussion, okay? Now the final contention to discuss here is that the quantum field again, that there are subatomic events that happen without no prior causes, apparently. Now this is not necessarily true, because what we see without any philosophical interpretation is things happening, and we just can't see a cause. You can't infer that there is no cause. And this is why there are two interpretations in physics. You have the indeterministic interpretation, which says these things happen with no causes, or you have the deterministic interpretation, which says these things have causes. And they're both epistemologically valid, which basically means, in terms of the theory of knowledge, they're both valid. But if you're a wise man, with everything in human experience, when they begin to exist, they have causes, why would you negate that from the quantum perspective? It would be irrational to do so. Even Immanuel Kant, the famous philosopher, he even argued that for you to disagree with causality because of experience is actually denying your own experiences. Imagine that, it's self-defeating. To deny causality because of your perceptions or experiences is denying your very perspectives in the first place. And he gave the example of ordering your perceptions. And let me give you an example. I have the ability to see this, mashallah, very nice, handsome young man, to see this young man with the blue top, to see all the way at the back and see the gentleman with the beard. I can order my own perceptions. But if someone ran across this auditorium, I can only see his front before I see his back. And Immanuel Kant said that the reason that we know when we can order our own perceptions or not is because of the innate concept of causality. So to even attempt to say experience denies causality is equivalent of denying your experience in the first place. So you're nowhere. So we have a cause, people. We have a cause for the whole universe, which we could have mentioned very easily in 5 seconds. But we wanted to work through it, talk about reality. Do you know why? Because another atheist contention is God of the gaps. You don't know what's going on in the universe, so you just squeeze God in as an explanation. But I think my discussion has shown it's not God of the gaps. Because we've worked with reality and had a discussion with using rational thinking, logic, and astrophysical evidence. So we know there is a cause. But what is the nature of this cause? Well, upon conceptual analysis, which basically means thinking deeply about this cause, thinking hard, being a critical thinker, what can we conclude? Well, if this cause created the physical universe, it must be aphysical. As the Quran says, Laysa kamithlihi shay. There is nothing like unto him. He is transcendent, outside of the universe. Laysa kamithlihi shay. Why? Because if he was just physical causes, then we'd have the absurdity of the infinite regress. Because if the physical universe was as a result of a physical cause, and then that physical cause was as a result of a physical cause, and that physical cause was as a result of a physical cause, and that physical cause was as a result of a physical cause, will we ever have the universe? No, let me give an example. Say I want to give this gentleman who is tightening his bottle a big kiss on the forehead. Yeah? But before I do that, I have to ask permission from the very jealous brother on the right. And then he has to ask permission. And then the other brother has to ask permission. If that goes on forever, am I going to give him a smooch? Oh, sorry, unfortunately, bro. Yeah, you see, I won't kiss him, right? And this is why it necessitates that this cause is aphysical, which also means then, therefore, eternal, because of the absurdity of the infinite regress. Not the infinity itself, but the infinite regress. Also, this cause must be intelligent, because it created the universe, and the universe has laws. Physical laws within the universe, like gravity. Who's going to deny that, people? No one. And it also has fine-tuning and constants, like the gravitational constant, and other constants. So lawgiver implies someone who has intelligence. Finally, this cause must have a will, must be able to choose. Why? Because if it's eternal, and it brought into existence the universe, think about this, people. If this cause is eternal, and it brought into existence the universe, which is finite, it must have chosen the universe to come into existence. Because physical causes always exist with their effect. Like 100 degrees and boiling water. It's 100 degrees and all of a sudden it's boiling water. But since we've established this cause is eternal and the effect is finite, must have chosen the universe to come into existence. So what have we done? We've just explained what the Quran explained 1400 years ago in the 112th chapter. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم قل هو الله أحد الله الصمد لم يلد ولم يولد ولم يكن له كفوا أحد. Say, He is God. He is uniquely one. He is eternal. He begets not, nor was He begotten. There is nothing like unto Him. He is divine. He is eternal. He has a will, which is implied in this verse, in this chapter. And also, He is intelligent, which is also implied in this chapter. So look what we've done. Just by using basic logic, using our minds, universe began to exist. Yeah, it came from nothing. It created itself. Or it was created. Then thinking a little bit deeply about some of the basic attributes of this creator, you come to the conclusion that we have good reasons to believe that the divine exists. Simples. Right? Wasn't that hard, was it? We could just summarize it again. We could do it in a few seconds. Universe began to exist. Did it come from nothing? No. Did it create itself? No. Must have been created. There you go. The biggest question of humanity has been solved in a few seconds. But that's what Muslims believe. It's such an innate concept. You don't have to do all this philosophy and gymnastics. I do this purposely because, I don't know, you're students. You like hearing people who think they know something, yeah? Or for the people who really want to have more deep thought about this perspective. But in reality, it's so intuitive, it's so real, it's slapping you in the face. Now, I don't want to be an abstract philosopher and have intellectual gymnastics. I want to give you one more argument in the final 10 minutes on why I believe God exists based upon the miraculous nature of the Quranic discourse. How can a book prove the divine? Well, the book can prove the divine from this perspective is because we can't find naturalistic explanation for the Quranic discourse. Impossible. We can't find a logical, natural explanation for the emergence of this book. And let me start by giving you a note, an understanding about the Quran. The Quran, according to Eastern and Western scholarship, has been described as an intrusive text. It wants to engage and impose itself on the inner dimensions of man, with his aqaliyah, his aql, his intellect, with his nafsiyah, with his internal disposition. It wants to impose itself, yes, this book, but in a positive way, people. And the way it does it in a positive way is by asking you profound questions. Asking you profound questions about man, life, and the universe. أَفَلَا يَنْظُرُونَ إِلَى الْإِبِلِ كَيْفَ خُلِقَتْ. Have you not seen the camel and how it was created? And as I mentioned before, وَفِي أَنفُسِكُمْ أَفَلَا تُبْصِرُونَ. And in themselves do they not see? وَكَذَلِكَ نُفَصِّلُ الْآيَاتِ لِقَوْمٍ يَتَفَكَّرُونَ. And thus do we explain our signs and evidences in detail for those who reflect. For those who reflect, people, the word يتفكرون for those who reflect comes from the Arabic triliteral stem فَكَرَا, which means in the classical dictionaries that the thing that you're reflecting upon, you must inquire deeply about the implications of that thing. The Quran makes mankind to think because we've been deluded with our immersive environments, with the iPhone, with alcohol, with TV, with drugs, with excessive entertainment. I'm not saying these things are bad. Well, the drugs maybe, unless it's for medicine. All these things have blinded us from the questions that we must ask ourselves. Who are we? Why are we? Whose are we? These are important questions that we just forget about. Just live your life, mate. That's what we say, don't we? Have a conversation with the typical cab driver in London. Oh, it's all bull. Anyway, yeah, beep, yeah. It's all bull crap, innit? Just live your life, mate. You want a pint? I'm not belittling him, but we all suffer from this. Xbox, immersive environment, I remember when I used to play Cossacks. Who's played Cossacks on PC before? Someone must have played. I love you, man. I'm telling you, me and you have a connection that no one else has now. Honestly. I would play that game, and I used to work for the police IT organization, but it's been disbanded now. It was a government organization. I was a project manager, and one of the senior police officers said, we play this game to develop our strategic thinking. So I bought it, and I start at 10 in the morning, and then I see my watch. It's 7 o'clock at night. Have you had that before? You're just on that game for hours? It's an amazing game. You take over everything. I always used to choose the, was it the Ottomans? Or no, the Algerians, right? You know, being a Muslim army and everything, yeah? Take over the world, yeah? You had all these tanks and, not tanks, you had these like medieval guns and it was really funny. Anyway, but the point is, it was an immersive environment. It stops you thinking these critical questions. And this is why psychologists have a term called self-annihilationism, which means you self-annihilate, you self-destroy, which basically essentially means you don't like your sense of self, so you always have something to drink, you always have some drugs. Don't get me wrong, I'm not condemning or actually, I'm not saying there's something intrinsically wrong about people who may have a pint now and then or may do whatever the things they want to do. But the point is, when these things are excessive, it's self-annihilationism. Even music itself has that power. Do you know that? I was discussing this today with a gentleman. And I said, look, if you don't believe music has power, then dance with no music. Yeah? You could only act like a fool when you have music, right? Press pause on one of the YouTube clips when people are dancing. Don't they look stupid? Don't they look stupid? They do, isn't it? Because only music has that ability. And if you look at sports physiology, when someone has like excessively kind of like violent or aggressive or passionate or motivational music, they always do better. So it can alter your state. Imagine if it's things like, I'm going to kill you, rape you, you know, those kind of crazy music. And that's what they did with the Marines, didn't they? When they were shooting whoever they were shooting, not to get political here, they had like, burn them, kill them, yeah, all that rock. And it creates that environment, changes your state. Anyway, so we forget about these questions, but the Quran, the eternal book from this perspective, makes us question, why are you? Where are you? Whose are you? Think about reality. But the Quran goes even further than this and challenges the whole of mankind with regards to its authorship. As it says in the second chapter, in the 23rd verse, وَإِنْ كُنْتُمْ فِي رَيْبِ مِمَّا نَزَلْنَا عَلَىٰ عَبْدِنَا فَأْتُوا بِسُورَةٍ مِنْ مِثْلِهِ وَدُعُوا شُهَدَاءَكُمْ مِنْ دُونِ اللَّهِ إِنْ كُنْتُمْ صَادِقِينَ. And if you are in doubt, people, talking to everybody who doubts, about this book, which we have sent down to our servant, referring to the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, upon whom be peace. Then bring one chapter like it, and call on your witnesses, and your supporters, and your scholars, and your philosophers, and your academics, and your thinkers, and your scientists, besides God, in kuntum sadiqeen, if you are truthful in your claim. Now we know this has something to do with the literary uniqueness of the Quranic discourse, but we don't have time, and it's another topic, maybe for another time. But let me just give you some interesting features of the Quranic discourse, which is not part of this discussion, but just to open your mind, to give you the window of opportunity to analyze and critically analyze this book. The Quran has an amazing numerical consonance, which basically means it has numerical coherence. This book was revealed over a 23-year period for specific times and places. One book. And this book was compiled together to have a coherence, a literary and numerical coherence in each chapter. Let me give an example. The term seven heavens is mentioned seven times in the Quran. The term dunya, the world, and akhirah, the hereafter, are mentioned the same times. Surah Baqarah, the second chapter of the Quran, is 286 verses and was revealed over a 9-year period for specific times and places, but brought together as a coherent piece. It's literally coherent from the perspective, if you read the book Discovering the Quran, A Contemporary Approach to a Veiled Text, Professor Neil Robertson, he goes verse by verse of the second chapter and links every verse rationally. Even if they're different themes, he links them together. It's a rationally coherent literary piece, although revealed over a 9-year period for different times and places. What does it say about the author? Must have known the future. But from a numerical perspective, cut the chapter in half. Wow! Yeah? And you have the 143rd verse. And within that verse, what word do you find? Middle. Chop it in the middle, you find the word middle. In the third chapter, the Quran mentions the likeness of Jesus in the sight of God, Allah, is like the likeness of Adam. They're both mentioned 25 times each in the Quran. And up to this verse, they're both mentioned 7 times. Let me not make an inference for you, but if it was revealed over a 23-year period for specific times and places and has this numerical coherence, that should make you think. Also, the Quranic discourse, as I just mentioned before, is a literary unique piece. The Quranic discourse, although has aesthetic reception, it's amazing, but I don't want to talk about that because it can be seen as subjective. But the structural features of the Arabic and the Quranic discourse de-scope the Arabic language. Because in the Arabic tradition, when you express yourself, you could always express yourself in prose or poetry. And prose has 2 subcategories, generally. These subcategories are saja, rhyme prose, mursal, straightforward speech. Poetry has to be in accordance with 16 rhythmical patterns called the al-bihar. The word bahar coming from the word sea. So it's like the waves on the sea. And these 16 rhythmical patterns make up Arabic poetry. The Quranic discourse doesn't belong to any of these categories. But everyone, any source text producer, human being speaking Arabic, writing Arabic, always falls into one of these known categories. But the Quran de-scopes the Arabic language for various technical reasons. And you can find these reasons out on the website, theinimitableQuran.com. Or for more popular perspective on the eloquence of the Quran, go to albayyinah.com from an amazing individual called Sheikh Numan Ali Khan. This is why A.J. Arbery, the famous British translator of the Quran, and his Quran is still used by academics today. He said the Quran is a unique fusion of prose and poetry. This is why Professor Bruce Lawrence, in his book, The Quran, A Biography, on page number 8, he said, as tangible signs, Quranic verses are expressive of an inexhaustible truth. They signify meaning layered within meaning, light upon light, miracle after miracle. Professor Martin Zamet from the Netherlands, he said the Quran is the most eminent written manifestation of the Arabic language. And the Quran came to challenge those best placed to understand the language, which was the Quraysh, the Arabs at the time of revelation. But they failed. This is why the famous linguist of the time, Walid ibn al-Mughira, he said, by God, this can't come from a human being. So again, an illiterate man from an illiterate people, unlearned in the sciences of eloquence, to come out with a blazing new style, a new literary form of Arabic that hasn't been emulated today. As Professor Arbuthnot says, although several attempts have been made to challenge the Quran, none have yet succeeded. This should raise questions. And finally, not only is the Quran a literally coherent piece, not only is it a numerically coherent piece, not only is it a unique literary form, but also it is a book that agrees with reality. The words of Sheikh or Professor Mohar Ali in his book, The Quran of the Orientalists, and the Orientalists, he makes an amazing point. And he says, the Quran is not contingent on a 7th century worldview on the understanding of reality. Now don't get me wrong, I don't agree with some of the Muslim apologists' view that the Quran predates science, because it doesn't. How could it? Because you're always going to do a backward interpretation. Logically, it doesn't make sense. I disagree with that fundamentally. And also, it assumes that scientism is the only way. Epistemologically, science is the only way to form conclusions about your life, and we've discussed this already. I'm talking about reality here, established fact. Why is the Quran not reflective on 7th century Arabia? It's not a reflection of 7th century Arabia. It actually reflects reality. And one way to establish this is actually the sequence of the developing human embryo, which can be found in Surah Mu'minun, verses 12 to 15, chapter 23, verses 12 to 15. And the Quran mentions certain key words. And the key words are nutfa, qararin makin, alaqa, mudgha, idham, lahma. And let me quickly, we don't have much time, and maybe another day, another topic. But the word nutfa from the Arabic perspective is something that is mixed when we refer to other verses, that the nutfa is a mixed substance. And grammatically it points to the view that it's a single substance made from two other single substances. And we know in the prophetic tradition that the nutfa, which means a drop, liquid, semen, sperm, comes from the mother and the father. And we know from the Quranic perspective this word nutfa is from the semen. So it's not a synonym for semen. As we see, the Quran says, nutfatin min maniyin. The nutfa, the drop, is from the semen. And also we have another Quranic verse that says, sulala. It's an extract of a fluid. So, which means something particular about this drop that is essential. So this was the first time in human understanding, and the classical scholars had this view, the first time in human understanding when we understood a concept that resembles the sperm that's contained in the liquid called semen. The Western world only had this understanding in the 17th century. So nutfa is a mixed substance from the male and the female, which are extracts of a particular substance. So the egg and the sperm, which come together to form the zygote. And the zygote then develops further with an outer shell, and you have the blastocyst. And the blastocyst, where does it go, people, after 6 or 7 days after fertilization? Who's a medic here? Apart from my good friend. You're a medic. Where does the blastocyst go, sister? Fertilization, implantation, right? And it sinks into the uterine wall. And it sinks deeper and deeper. And there is a fibrin clot over it, right? And it's secure. This is in line with the words qararin makin, which means to place firmly, to fix firmly. Then after, from this stage, you have alaqa. Alaqa in the Arabic language, according to Lisan al-Arab, which is an Arabic text, classical Arabic text, and Edward Lane's lexicon, which is an academic text for Arabic. Alaqa means something that's hanging or suspended. It means a leech-like substance. Or it means something sticky that could cling. Now let's take these meanings. John Allen and Beverly Kramer, in the book which I believe is an introduction to human embryology, and Ram Sharma and many others, modern embryologists, they say that the embryo is connected to what? The connecting stalk. And these very embryologists use the word hanging and suspended. The role of the connecting stalk is to hang and suspend the embryo. What does alaqa mean? Hang and suspend. Also, we have the alaqa to mean a worm or a leech-like substance. If you go to around day 20 to 25, you have two processes happening. These processes are called neurulation and the folding of the embryo. You have the neural folds, and you have longitudinal folding where the head and the tail are brought together closer. The combination of these two processes makes it look like a leech. The embryologists call it a cylindrical structure. But other embryologists have called it, and hear this, they've said worm, or they've said leech. They've said these things independently. Switch off your phone, or you get a big tar. As they say in Pakistan, yeah? There's a Punjabi saying, it's called Sonyar di tuk tuk lahar di tar. Which basically means, the goldsmith goes tap, 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 and the blacksmith goes tar, yeah? I want you kidding though, yeah? I won't do that. So, it looks like a leech. And from the alaqa, you have a mudgha. Mudgha means, according to the classical dictionaries and Lane's lexicon, something that's a chewed piece of meat, a morsel of flesh, something which the teeth have left marks on it. I'm telling you, go to the stage, go to the photos, the scansions, the graphs, when the somite formation, and then they go and travel to the notochord, and they form sclerotomes. What does it look like? Something's bitten something. Yeah? By anything. Meat, date, chewing gum, your skin, whatever you want. If you're Tyson, someone else's ear. Yeah? Do you remember Tyson, yeah? Whatever. It would look like something that's been bitten. Mudgha. And also, the Quran also affirms elsewhere that the word mudgha is something that's been formed and unformed, which can refer to the organogenetic period. And at this stage, which is about 5 weeks or 4 weeks, that the organs have started to develop but are not fully yet formed. And after the mudra, you have idham. Idham basically means bones, or specifically limb bones. And we have the formation of the limb bones, the cartilaginous models of the bones. After that, what happens? Lahma. Fakasona, which means that then we clothe the idham, the bones, with lahma. It doesn't say then we created the muscles over the bones. It says then we clothe the bones with flesh. Now the myoblasts, which are the precursor cells for muscle formation, they migrate distally. Clothing, to encase, to clothe. The word fakasona means to clothe, to encase, to cover. They migrate distally and they aggregate over the bones to form muscles. Now someone says, why does it mention lahma, muscle? Why does it mention meat? Because lahma actually means meat, not muscle. And why does it mention the Arabic word adlat, which means muscle? Because according to John Allen and Beverly Kramer, the embryologists, they say, well, it's not only muscle that forms at this stage, it's also other connective tissue like tendons. And meat encompasses not only muscle, but if you have a good shawarma, you'd have tendons in there too. So, this is a very brief 101 on embryology, but look, it agrees with reality. The only claim against the Quranic narrative is, you copied the Greeks, Galen, Aristotle. Well, let's go to Galen, Aristotle. I had to do that in the original Greek, by the way. I went to Galen. What does he mention? He mentions the word spermados. Spermados in the Greek language, at the second century understanding, actually meant just the physical fluid, nothing specific from it. But the word nutfa is something that's an extract, as we said. It's a singular substance. It's from the semen, not the semen itself. So from this onset, the two words don't marry. Because the Galenic understanding was just the whole semen in general. But the Quranic understanding is nutfa. And semen in Arabic is not nutfa, it's mani or maniyin. This is where we have all the prophetic traditions, like Bukhari, Ibn Majah, Muslim, etc. The collections of these prophetic traditions that actually state that Aisha, for instance, or radiallahu anha, the wife of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wasallam, washed the mani or the maniyin from the clothes of the Prophet. Never used the word nutfa. So nutfa is not a synonym for semen, which means spermatos in Greek, so the two terms don't even marry. Let me give you another example. Galen, he says sperm comes from blood. Then he says the two semens mix, and after that it's mixed with menstrual blood. The Quran doesn't mention any of this. So the Quran knew, or the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam knew what was right and left what was wrong. What does that imply? It supports our thesis. What about Aristotle? Aristotle had the ridiculous idea that the semen mixed with menstrual blood. Menstrual blood in Arabic is not alaqa, it actually means it's hayd. Right? The Quran doesn't mention this. The Quran doesn't mention this. Also, Aristotle had a bizarre view that depending where the embryo is, it's going to be a male or female. If it's on the left, it's either male, or if it's on the right, it's either female. We could do a greater analysis of the situation, but the point is, the 7th century understanding was a Greek understanding, and they weren't even similar. To claim that the Prophet knew what was wrong, upon whom be peace, and kept what was right, actually opens a huge can of worms. It means he knew what was right, even though he was in the 7th century. So that should raise some questions. And the reason I said this is a sign for the divine, is because if you can't find a naturalistic explanation, it's a sign to the transcendent, to God, to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Subhanakallahumma wa bihamdika. Ashhadu an la ilaha illa anta wa astaghfiruka wa atubu ilayk. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you very much and your patience for listening.